From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The first big-ticket legislation from House Democrats heads to the floor this week. Its champion, our guest this hour, Maryland Democratic Congressman John Sarbanes.
The Democratic majority wants to give you your voice back with H.R. 1, which is literally for the people.
House Resolution 1. It includes proposals such as public financing for campaigns, ending Citizens United, requiring presidential candidates to disclose tax returns, automatic voter registration, making Election Day a federal holiday, and ending partisan gerrymandering. Democrats call it the For the People Act, but according to Ohio Republican Congressman Jim Jordan,
a more accurate title would be For the People Who Want Democrats to Win Elections from now on. The bill includes a laundry list of tired proposals designed to benefit the majority by tilting the playing field in their favor. It's not a stretch to label many of these proposals radical.
Well, this hour On Point, we'll dig into House Resolution 1 and the Democrats' big push against corruption and some concerns with the bill as well. And you can join us. What do you make of these ideas from congressional Democrats? Are they too radical, as Congressman Jim Jordan says, or the right way forward to really drain the swamp in Washington? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now today from Washington is Maryland Democratic Congressman John Sarbanes. He is the primary sponsor for House Resolution 1. Congressman Sarbanes, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Meghna.
It's terrific to have you. So first of all, I mean, so it's going to a floor vote here fairly soon, H.R. 1. But give us your big picture goal here. What are Democrats trying to accomplish with this first bill presented to the House?
Well, what we're trying to accomplish is responding to the appetite we've seen out in the electorate and among the public for real change in Washington. People really want us to clean up politics. They want to fight corruption. They want to unrig the system. This is the message that's been coming through loud and clear over the last few years, but particularly coming off the 2018 election, the public, the voters out there were really sending a powerful message that they want to see things change here. They want to be respected again. They want to feel like their voice matters. And so we've put together a very comprehensive package of democracy reforms that, if you distill it down, Meghna, what it really is saying on behalf of the voters is, let's make it possible for us to register and vote in America without that being difficult. You know, we don't want to have to run an obstacle course to get to the ballot box. So let's strengthen registration and voting opportunities all across the country. The second thing is, when lawmakers come to Washington, it's reasonable for the public to expect them to behave themselves. So we want to make sure there's good ethics and transparency and accountability in the way things operate in Washington. And lastly, people don't want their representatives getting tangled up in the money. And big money has way too much influence in Washington. Secret money pours into our politics in ways that really diminish the voices of everyday citizens. So we push back against that influence of big money in H.R. 1. So you put all that together, and this is a very comprehensive set of reforms that respects the voters, respects the public, gives them their voice back. And that's responding to a promise we made to the voters in 2018 that this would be the first order of business.
Right. So let's listen to a little bit of what House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said about H.R. 1 to this point that you're making, that Democrats see it as a way to respond to what voters told them in the 2018 midterms. Here's the speaker.
We gave people confidence that this could happen in a way that was in the people's interest, not the special interest, because of H.R. 1. It's important for what it does. It's important for the confidence it gives people that their voices and their concerns are heard. So that restoring the people's faith in government works is really our agenda.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in January. On the other hand, Congressman Sarbanes, as you know, you've got some stiff resistance coming from folks like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He often has spoken against H.R. 1 on the Senate floor. Here's what he said in January. He coined a nickname for the Democrats' signature piece of legislation.
They're so focused on this legislation that they've given it the ceremonial designation of H.R. 1. Their top priority. I think it's more accurately could be described another way, the Democratic Politician Protection Act. Mr. President, this sprawling, comprehensive proposal is basically the far left's entire Christmas wish list where our nation's political process is concerned.
That's the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in January. Congressman Sarbanes, we're going to dig into the details of H.R. 1 here with you in just a second. But first of all, respond to what Senator McConnell said there. I mean, that is the kind of pushback you are hearing and will hear from the other side of the aisle for Democratic's reform efforts here.
Well, sure. I mean, frankly, to have Mitch McConnell standing up against this bill, it seems to me is a badge of honor for H.R. 1 because he's been for decades, he's been really trying to hide the democracy behind a curtain, open up the democracy to the influence of special interests and big money and so forth. So I'm not surprised that he's leaning in against this. I think he's wrong. It's a miscalculation on his part to suggest that this is a Democratic power grab, which is how he's painted it. This is a power grab on behalf of the people. Everything in here comes from everyday citizens, the priorities that they've put forward, they've asked us about. I mean, why is it a Democratic power grab, for example, to just make it more possible for people to register and vote in America? That benefits everybody, Republicans, Democrats, and independents. Why is it a Democratic power grab to insist on ethics and accountability in Washington? That respects every voter and every citizen across the political spectrum. And I can tell you that it doesn't matter what party people belong to, when they look at Washington and feel that big money and special interests have too much influence, they want that to change. They want power to come back to them, the people. So this is the people standing up. And H.R. 1 is the vehicle that we've crafted, listening carefully to our constituents and to folks all across the country to make sure that they get their voice back. So we think that we've got a very strong package here that reflects what people want to see. And if Mitch McConnell's the immovable object in this equation, then I think H.R. 1 and the will of the people is the unstoppable force. And I think we're in a good position to carry forward what the public wants to see.
An unstoppable force perhaps in the House, but Mitch McConnell isn't just any unmovable object. He's the Senate Majority Leader. So I think you're going to hit quite of a brick wall in the Senate. But Representative Sarbanes, let's just talk about some specifics here. I mean, you talked about automatic voter registration, for example,
yes,
in the bill here. Some of the pushback that's been coming on that idea, for example, points to, say, California that launched automatic voter registration and had, you know, more than a little bit of a hiccup there, that the DMV in California that was doing these voter registrations submitted some 23,000 incorrect registrations to the state there. So folks are looking at that and saying, well, if that's the model that we're following, aren't we essentially opening the door to a lot of errors in trying to get people registered to vote?
If you put these systems in place, you obviously work kinks out on the front end of anything that's being implemented. That's not a reason not to push forward and make sure that those systems work well. And California has done that now. They've got a good system in place. The benefit you're getting is that you're creating more access to the ballot box and democracy on behalf of millions of people across the country. And so this idea of automatic voter registration, it's really a best practice. If you look at peer nations around the world, they do this. You look at how it's been implemented in a number of states across the country. It's a very strong measure that just facilitates people being able to get registered, get that information into a place where the registration is easy and the opportunity is there, and then they can move on from that to the ballot box and voting. So these are best practices. If you look at H.R. 1, all of the measures, and a lot of these, by the way, came from John Lewis's Voter Empowerment Act. These are all measures that represent and reflect best practices across the country to make sure that when we get to Election Day or early voting, people have what they need to get to the ballot box, register their judgment in the election, feel like their voice matters, and their vote has been counted. So that's what these are all about.
So let me ask you, though, there's a deeper concern here for folks who are worried about H.R. 1. And they see the package of ideas around expanding voting rights as essentially the Democrats' move to federalize the elections process. And of course, as you well know, the elections process has long been something that's been controlled by the states. Is that not a legitimate concern, that it would represent a pretty fundamental shift in terms of who's making the rules around how people vote?
It's not federalizing it, because the states continue to retain the authority to build the infrastructure on how voting occurs there. What we're doing is we're saying to the states that there ought to be some uniform standards in place, best practices across the country. And as I say, this reflects things that have been shown to work in certain kind of states, and we think that for that reason it makes sense to expand those opportunities more broadly. So it's really the states are being asked to step up and meet certain standards. But, you know, they have the control and the authority over the election infrastructure within each individual state. They'll figure out how to meet those standards. We're going to provide some funds through the Help America Vote Act and otherwise to states to help them get to those standards. But that's not a federalizing of voting in America. That's the federal government coming in, providing support to the states, setting some goals and standards for what the practices ought to be. And all of that is designed to enhance the voice of the average American out there.
Well, we have to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about two other major parts of H.R. 1 that has to do with partisan gerrymandering and campaign finance. So Congressman John Sarbanes, Democrat of Maryland, stand by here for just a second. We are talking about the Democrats' big push, their marquee bill. It's called H.R. 1. It's a sweeping anti-corruption bill, as the Democrats see it. Folks on the other side of the aisle and also some advocacy groups do have some concerns as well. So we're going to talk about those when we come back. What's your question for Congressman John Sarbanes? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're joined this hour by Congressman John Sarbanes. He's Democrat of Maryland, and he's the primary sponsor of H.R. 1. It's the House Democrats' first big bill. They're calling it a sweeping anti-corruption bill. It'll head to the House floor for a vote pretty soon, and it deals with everything from voting rights to the structure of the Federal Election Commission to campaign finance and partisan gerrymandering. So we want to know what your question is for the congressman. Congressman Sarbanes, let's talk about gerrymandering here for a second, because it's an issue in a lot of states. So how is it that H.R. 1 would seek to end partisan gerrymandering?
So H.R. 1 would require every state in the country to set up a process for redistricting that would have an independent redistricting commission, a nonpartisan commission that would decide how the lines are drawn for congressional districts. This is modeled after what's happened in a number of states across the country. California, for example, has an independent redistricting commission. It's something that the voters have been drawn to. There's a lot of frustration out there when you talk to people about how redistricting is done, political gerrymandering. I mean, the shorthand expression of that frustration is people feel like politicians pick their voters instead of voters picking their politicians when it comes to how these lines are drawn. So I think it's a fair grievance on the part of the public. And H.R. 1 acknowledges that under the time, place, manner authority that we have under the Constitution in terms of how to guide elections and how things are done in the states. We can set that standard. We can require every state to put this kind of a commission in place, and then the state pulls it together, meets the criteria that are set forth for that independent, nonpartisan approach. And I think if we do that everywhere, that we will take the politics out of redistricting. We won't have this political gerrymandering anymore, and I think people will feel more respected. Mm. So that was a key reform that's included in H.R. 1.
Right. Now, as you well know, your very own district, Maryland's 3rd, may be one of the most gerrymandered in the country. I mean, a federal judge called it a broken-winged pterodactyl lying prostrate across the center of the state, a blood spatter, a Rorschach test, a praying mantis. I mean, this could end up – I mean, if this ever goes through, this would have an effect on the very shape of your own very gerrymandered district.
It would affect every district in the country, and I think you'd have a process in place that would be more fair for how these districts are drawn so they don't have these crazy shapes to them. I mean, you know, you can't in a place like Maryland, you can't draw a district that's a rectangle because it's a funny-shaped state to begin with. But you can have standards that are more objective, and that's the goal of the redistricting reform that is included, the national redistricting reform that's included in H.R. 1. And again, the idea here is respect for the voter. People just want the system to treat them fairly, whether it's voting and getting to the ballot box, whether it's the way lines are drawn in terms of congressional districts, whether it's respecting the idea that when you come to Washington, you occupy these offices in the public trust and have to act in an ethical way. And it definitely relates to the idea that the people's voice, not the voice of big money and special interests, should be what calls the shots in Washington on policy. And so H.R. 1 is trying to meet that expectation that the public has.
Now, just to be clear, though, I was seeing that you told the Washington Post, and this is what they write, that, quote, the wonky shape of the – this is the Post writing – the wonky shape of the 3rd District is a feature, not a bug. And you told them, as a national legislator, it's actually in my interest to get input from a lot of different kinds of communities because I'm being asked to vote on legislation that affects the whole country. I don't really understand that quote here, because partisan gerrymandering draws these torturous districts so that you don't get a lot of input from different kinds of people.
I think the point there is that if you represent a lot of different communities as a national legislator, you're hearing from different points of view. And if those points of view assemble around a particular priority, let's say you're hearing from everybody in your district that healthcare reform is critical, or tax reform is critical, or certain kinds of response to prescription drug pricing is critical. If that's coming from everywhere in a diverse district that you represent, then you know that as a national legislator, you have to pick up and fight on that issue on behalf of the broad public. Having said that, you can still aspire to have these district lines drawn in a way that's more fair, more sensible, and that's what the independent redistricting approach would do. The key is that you have to fix it everywhere, because mm-hmm. if you only do it in some places and not others, then the places where you're not doing it will become even more political. The gerrymandering that occurs there will become even more intense to compensate for what's happening other places. So the solution has to be across the board. Every state needs to step up and approach this through an independent commission process. If we do that, I think the public will feel much better about how these district lines are drawn.
Okay. So H.R. 1 is such a huge bill that we could spend quite a bit of time talking about any one particular part of it. So if you don't mind, I want to sort of like throw a little stone here and skip to the next part.
Sure.
Because campaign finance reform is a huge aspect of this bill, and H.R. 1 proposes to make some significant changes. So first of all, tell us a little bit more about this idea of more public financing for federal-level elections. What does H.R. 1 propose there?
So one of the things we've been hearing from the public out there is that they really feel like the current campaign finance system is built in a way that gives special interests and big money folks a lot of influence, because they're the ones that are contributing to campaigns. You look at PAC donations to campaigns, high-end donors, and so forth. And the fact of the matter is that if a lot of money comes in for campaigns from special interests and insiders and big money folks, then the institution of Congress is going to lean in their direction. That's just human nature. So the question is, can you build a new system for funding campaigns that gives the people power, that sort of gives them ownership again of the democracy and lets them call the shots? So what we've proposed for members of Congress, and this is a completely voluntary system, nobody has to participate in this. It's a choice that a candidate can make. But we've created a system where candidates could collect small donations. They could earn a 6-to-1 match on those donations if they agree to give up PAC money and do certain other things that show they're respecting the public and not leaning towards the special interest. But if they do that, then that small donation that comes in from an everyday American gets amplified, and that American then has power. They can step onto the field of their own democracy as a power player, and they can get the attention of candidates. And then what will happen is candidates will start spending their time with real people instead of spending their time hanging out with lobbyists on K Street or hanging out with the big donors and the PACs and so forth. Because the problem here is, Meghna, that you start to think like the company you keep. And if you're hanging out with the lobbyists and the big money crowd, then their priorities become your priorities. If you spend your time with everyday Americans because you can go there to power your campaign because we've got a new way of funding campaigns in America, then the priorities of everyday citizens are going to be your priorities as a legislator, and you're going to bring those to Washington and you're going to fight for those priorities. So we think this is a power move on behalf of the broad public to say, hey, we're stepping up. We want to take ownership of this system. We want to be the one who has the voice that counts.
Okay. So that's in terms of more public financing of campaigns. And we can dig into that in a second. But I want to play a little bit of tape here regarding some pushback that H.R. 1 is getting in terms of the parts of the bill seeking to make campaign communications more transparent. Okay, so here is Ohio Republican Congressman Jim Jordan. He's criticizing H.R. 1 for how it could affect campaign finance and the president himself.
H.R. 1 would steer potentially billions of dollars to political allies in the name of campaign finance empowerment, restrict Americans' right to free speech, and exact political retribution on the president of the United States. Unfortunately, this isn't all that surprising. This is just the latest in a series of attacks by the Democrats to stifle the free exchange of ideas.
That's Congressman Jim Jordan saying H.R. 1 would stifle the free exchange of ideas. Congressman Sarbanes, stand by here for just a second because I want to bring in another person briefly into this conversation who shares those concerns. David Keating joins us. He's with us from Alexandria, Virginia today. He's president of the Institute for Free Speech, and last month he testified about H.R. 1 before the House Administration Committee. He's also a former executive director at the Club for Growth. David Keating, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So talk to me specifically about your concerns regarding free speech and H.R. 1. You see the two as incompatible. Why is that?
Oh, well, definitely. Well, free speech for all, that's the goal of the First Amendment to our Constitution. That's part of what makes America the best country in the world. And free speech was vital for the civil rights movement. It was vital for LGBTQ rights, tax reform, much more. But this bill, the way it's structured, before a nonprofit group speaks out on government, they're going to have to spend thousands of dollars to hire a lawyer to find out if it's okay to speak. And in many cases, they're going to have to fill out reams of paperwork for the Federal Election Commission. They're going to have to declare on a government form what candidate they back with their speech, even though they're not backing a candidate at all. And then there are all kinds of new disclaimer rules in the bill, including disclaimers that are going to be 18 seconds long for a podcast or radio ad. So this is not really how we should be doing things in America. It's not for the people to subsidize the speech of politicians and to limit the speech of the citizens. And that's what H.R. 1 would do. And it's not just us that says this. I think the two leading groups that work on free speech in the country are our group and the ACLU. And the ACLU put out a 13-page letter going point by point on the ways this bill would limit the speech of groups trying to change government policies.
Right. So, Congressman Sarbanes, let me get you to respond to that, because I, too, was looking at the ACLU's concerns about H.R. 1. Overall, the group supports the idea of reforming elections and finance, campaign finance in America, but they are particularly concerned with aspects of H.R. 1, such as the Disclose Act, which is within the bill. And here's what the ACLU says. They say the Disclose Act would regulate communications that merely mention a candidate for office if an election is near. It would also regulate communications that, quote, support, promote, attack, or oppose the election of a candidate. These standards are very unclear and entirely subjective, which will lead to confusion and ultimately less speech. I mean, the ACLU goes so far as even to suggest that these parts of H.R. 1 might be unconstitutional, Congressman Sarbanes.
Well, I think we're very comfortable and confident that the provisions in the Disclose Act, which is part of H.R. 1, do pass constitutional muster. I mean, if you look back at the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court, they've actually invited the idea of more disclosure, not less. So we think we're meeting that standard with H.R. 1. The fact of the matter is that when you talk to people out there, they are enraged by a situation that exists now, which is that you can have millionaires, billionaires putting tons of money behind political speech but not having to say who they are. This is the secret money that we've been talking about. And the disclosure parts of this bill simply say that people that contribute to get into the political speech arena contribute more than $10,000. That has to be disclosed because the public wants to know. It's going to affect the average person's perspective on a message that's coming at them is going to be affected by knowing who is behind that message. And this is something that you hear in every town hall, every constituent you talk to. They're really upset at this idea that people can hide behind these kind of generic disclaimer things and not indicate who they are, the money that's being spent behind that political speech. So this is basic disclosure, and I respect the ACLU, but I think on this one, we're in a very solid place to say the people that give a lot of money to step into the political arena with speech, they have to identify themselves because that helps the audience, the people that are receiving that message, make some kind of judgment about the issues that are being presented. So that's very fair, and it's absolutely something the public has an appetite for.
David Keating, would you like to respond to that?
Sure. Look, people who hold views that are unpopular are not going to be willing to step into the public sphere if they're giving money to a group. And you don't have to look back far in our history to see that. If you look in the southern states, you look at Alabama, the state of Alabama wanted the NAACP membership list in the 1950s. Why did they want that? Did they want it for transparency, to know who was behind the NAACP? Of course they did, because they wanted to shut the group down. And that's the kind of danger that H.R. 1 would have. There will be other groups in the future that are going to express, at the time, unpopular views that then eventually will be accepted. But we're going to be suppressing that speech by forcing people to disclose what policies they want to see government changes. So whether it's constitutional or not, and both our group, the Institute for Free Speech, and the ACLU believes H.R. 1, as written, unconstitutionally restricts our free speech or not, this is bad policy. Now, we're not talking about disclosure of contributions for candidates, parties, and PACs. That's the law now. Also, the law now with a recent decision is if people give to a group and that group runs an ad urging the election or defeat of a candidate, those people have to be disclosed. But what we're talking about is looking at other things. And this kind of mentality, I'll tell you something, I spoke with a Republican member of Congress, and he says, you know, if we want to take this transparency to further and further, why don't we pass a bill saying that newspapers have to reveal their sources when they're reporting on congressional candidates? No more anonymous sources on candidates. And you know what? Anonymous sources are very important. You look at the reporting in the race, I think, was it in Alabama, where they had that, the Republicans had that candidate that liked young girls. That was groundbreaking reporting by the Washington Post.
Right.
A lot of it was not sourced by, you know, other than anonymous people initially.
Well, David
and
Keating,
that's vital to have that information come out.
David Keating, I've just got to take a quick break here, and I want to thank you so much for joining us. David Keating is president of the Institute for Free Speech, and last month he testified about H.R. 1 before the House Administration Committee. David Keating, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Congressman Sarbanes, we'll pick up on some of the thoughts that Mr. Keating shared with us just now when we come back from our break. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Congressman John Sarbanes. He's Democrat of Maryland and the primary sponsor of H.R. 1, House Democrats' sweeping first big proposal in this congressional session that has to do with anti-corruption. It's an anti-corruption bill, as Democrats call it. We're also talking about some concerns that Republicans and advocates have about the bill as well. And callers, you've been very patient. I promise I will get to you in just a minute here. But Congressman Sarbanes, you know, in talking about the campaign finance provisions of H.R. 1, I find it helpful to sort of put an example around what some of the concerns are. So bear with me for just a second, because this example comes from the ACLU and their concerns about speech and the regulation of speech that H.R. 1 may bring to the table. So here's what the ACLU says. They say, for example, hypothetical, a California-based organization could place an ad describing a, quote, crisis at the southern border, and in that ad they could criticize Senator Kamala Harris for failing to support the president's efforts to build a wall. Now, that organization, under H.R. 1, if it passed, would then have to disclose all of its donors that gave above a certain amount of money because the ad opposes the senator's positions and therefore could be found to oppose her election. And the ACLU has concerns about that because they say it could stifle donors' willingness to give. The vaguely defined rules about what constitutes campaign-related communications could end up leading groups like labor unions and other advocacy groups like Planned Parenthood to self-censor out of fear of crossing the Act's provisions. That's the concern they have. Is it not warranted?
Well, I think it gets this question of donations above a certain amount. We think we've drawn the line in a place that makes sense. People who are giving more than $10,000 to affect speech in the political arena like that, we think they ought to stand behind that contribution. And I want to get back to something that David Keating said, because it was sort of a head fake, this idea that, you know, people are going to have to turn over membership lists and all the rest of it. That is not what H.R. 1 is going to do. This is getting to the folks that right now are in a position to write big checks and affect speech in the political space but have no accountability. So we've drawn the line in a place where we think we're getting to the millionaires, the big donors who are out there behind the curtain not having to say who they are. You know, the Koch brothers is an example that I could bring to bear. Koch brothers, other kinds of millionaires spending lots of money, that's not disclosed. We want to make sure that they are accountable for the money that they're putting into our politics. That's all H.R. 1 is trying to achieve. The other thing I want to mention, because it's very, very important, is that we require a lot more disclosure when it comes to how foreign money is coming into our politics. And as we all know, based on what's happened over the last couple of election cycles, this threat, the kind of insidious threat that's coming from foreign interests who are trying to get into our politics and can use money to do that, that's very serious. This disclosure will help combat the interference that can come from those foreign interests. And we think that's extremely important as well.
Well, let's finally get to our callers because they have been patient. Elizabeth is calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
This is wonderful to be able to ask a question of the congressman. It's a question and a comment.
Well, so go ahead and give us your question then, Elizabeth.
Okay. So H.R. 1 seems to be a democracy correction for a democracy that has swung too far to the right, and it will definitely bring it back to the constitutional definition of democracy if H.R. 1 is voted for.
And so your question, so, Elizabeth?
Are you trying to rebalance democracy back to where it should be?
Mm. Well, Elizabeth, thank you for your call. Congressman Sarbanes, what do you say?
Yeah, we are trying to rebalance it, but I wouldn't say we're trying to rebalance it on the political spectrum. This is not about right or left. This is about the people versus the special interests. What's happened over the last few decades, really, is that big money, insiders, lobbyists, special interests, they've pretty much captured the ecosystem in Washington. So they're the ones that are calling the shots. It's basically an inside affair in Washington. And the public has gotten fed up with this. I mean, they're fit to be tied. They look at Washington. They don't think their voice matters anymore. They're kind of on the outside with their noses pressed up at the glass, looking in on some conference room on K Street and saying, why don't we matter as the American public? So the rebalancing here is not like from right to left or the middle or that kind of thing in terms of the ideological spectrum. The rebalancing is to get our democracy back to where it actually reflects the will of the people. It responds to everyday citizens. And that is that's an absolutely justified expectation on the part of people out there. And as I said at the outset, I can digest this down very easily. All that we're trying to achieve with H.R. 1 is so that the voters can get to the ballot box without running an obstacle course. That's number one. Number two, they have a right to expect that when people go to Washington to serve them, that those people will behave themselves. That's about ethics and accountability. We insist on that with H.R. 1. And lastly, they have a right to expect that we won't get tangled up in the money, that will continue to represent their interests and not the interests of the well-heeled donors and the PACs and the corporations. And H.R. 1 is determined to make sure that everyday citizens are the ones that call the shots in Washington. So that's the rebalancing we want. We want to move this back to being a government, in Abraham Lincoln's words, that is of, by, and for the people. And that's why we called H.R. 1 the For the People Act.
Well, so then how do ideas like changing the makeup of the Federal Election Commission play into this? Because, I mean, it's been, 40-ish years, maybe a bit more than that, that the FEC has had a 6-member body with the idea of it being, politically balanced. The bill wants to change the FEC makeup to 5, right, which would end up having it be 3-2 in most situations based on whatever party is in power. I mean, some people see that as a political weaponizing of the FEC.
Actually, it's the opposite. What's happened now is that the gridlock that exists at the FEC is really benefiting the money interests out there because the FEC cannot take action in real time. You particularly see this, Magna, when you get into like the home stretch of the campaign season, the last 6-8 weeks, because that's when a lot of the mischief gets done by these moneyed interests out there. And because the FEC can't move fast in real time to deal with that, what happens is we always wake up after the election, find out there's been all of these violations. It's too late at that point because the election's already happened. The money people have been able to weigh in and get their way. So we want the FEC to be able to operate. It's not doing that now. It's gridlocked. If you put it into a five-person commission, the way that would come together, the criteria that would apply, the standards would make it so that it could operate in a way that isn't partisan but professional. And we want it to be able to conduct its affairs that way and be meaningful and consequential as a cop on the beat. So that's the idea behind the FEC reform. And if you look at the provisions—
But Congressman, I'm sorry, can I just jump in here for a second? Because, the idealism behind that perhaps is laudable. But practically speaking, I mean, in looking at other commissions that have an odd number of commissioners, it ends up always being partisan. Yes, they are acting professionally, but they're also still partisan. And so you have these swings from administration to administration in terms of the goals and the efforts of these commissions. Why not stick with what's essentially a neutral by design FEC commission?
The neutral by design FEC commission right now has been weaponized, to use your term, so that it doesn't do anything. It's completely ineffective. It's completely gridlocked. It can't act on any of the cases that come before it. We have to break that gridlock so it can actually function in an effective way. You can do that responsibly with a five-member commission. If you look at how the bill is drafted, it's very careful to make sure that the commission will act in a responsible and professional manner. I think I don't think that's idealistic. I think that's very practical in terms of making the commission work in a way that meets the expectations of the broad public, which is you are the FEC. You need to be policing what's going on with the money players in our democracy and making sure they're not leaning on our democracy. And that's what the FEC could do if we reconstitute it in the ways that H.R. 1 proposes. So we're very confident that this will be an improvement overall to the current situation.
Mm. Well, let's go back to the callers. David is calling from Fairfield, Connecticut. David, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Congressman, why don't I hear anything in H.R. 1 about term limits? If it's appropriate for the president to only be in for two terms, why shouldn't there be limits on the Senate and the Congress for how long you all should have a job? I mean, I don't think there should be I don't think politicians should be a permanent job. I think it should be a service to the country and not something that's a career. So I'll listen offline, but if you can tell me why that's not in there and what the justification is for 20, 30, 40, 50 years worth of being an elected official. Thank you.
So, the term limit thing always comes up. I know that some people kind of lean into that as a remedy for the current problems that they see with the system. I've always been of the view that the voters have the ability to terminate my service in Congress every 2 years. You want to give voters that authority and not arbitrarily take it away from them. In fact, in some places where you have term limits, what occurs often is it's the lobbyists who don't have term limits who end up running the show because they're the only ones around who've got any kind of continuity. I will say this. If you reform the campaign finance system, which right now does benefit incumbents because they're the ones that can go find the money from the PACs and the special interests, they have the relationships. If you make changes so that everyday citizens can actually step up and run for office as candidates by collecting small donations and earning matching funds, that in effect will help curb this incumbency of people who aren't really serving the public. So then you'll get folks, if somebody is just sitting there with their feet up on the desk and they're not paying attention to their constituents, they're going to be vulnerable under a system that allows candidates to run and compete based on collecting small donations and earning matching funds. And by the way, I did want to make the point, Magna, because I didn't get a chance to do this earlier, that the matching funds that we're talking about coming in and amplifying the voices of small donors, we are creating that fund by putting a surcharge on the bad actors in our system. So you know, industry lawbreakers, high-end tax cheats who have committed, you know, crimes and have civil penalties against them and so forth. We're going to put a very small surcharge on that. That's where the dollars are going to come from to support this matching system. But to the caller's question, we can put things in place, and H.R. 1 does this, that means that incumbents who shouldn't be there because they're not paying attention to the public anymore, they will be vulnerable. Mm. But incumbents who are doing a good job and are responsive to their constituents and are exactly the kind of people that you would want to see continue in office, they'll be strengthened by H.R. 1, and they should be because they're representing the public and their constituents.
Let's get at least one more call in here. Let's go to Chris, who's calling from Randolph, Vermont. Chris, what's your question for Congressman Sarbanes?
Hey, great. Thank you, Meghna, and thank you, Congressman Sarbanes. First, I guess I would say that I appreciate the comprehensive nature of H.R. 1, but I am wondering if this is becoming the perfection is the enemy of the good. And I would feel much more comfortable with dealing with Citizens United and the gerrymandering. If you could deal with those two pieces, I feel like when it went to the Senate, there would be a lot more support and pressure on the Senate to do something. So I wonder how you feel about, like, breaking this up into pieces and dealing with kind of the biggest things first.
That's a great question, Chris. And actually, at the same time that we have this package as a package coming to the House floor, and we hope to pass it this week, we also have members that are introducing sort of component parts of the package and being able to explore the potential for those to move along on a companion track. And we'll be able to test what you're suggesting, which is, you know, is there an appetite in the Senate to gather up support around certain pieces of this legislation? But we felt it was very important, because we were hearing this from the public, to put these three areas of reform together and link them, that being the voting reforms, the ethics reforms, and the campaign finance reforms. Because what we're hearing from people out in the country is, if you fix one of these things and you don't fix the others, we're still basically going to be left out. If you make it easier for me to get to the ballot box, but the person I vote for gets to Washington and doesn't behave themselves or gets captured or taken hostage by big money and special interests, then you haven't solved my problem as a citizen of feeling like the system is responsive to me and respects me. So that's why we wanted to address all of these together. But we think if we pass it, it will create momentum and pressure that may be able to unlodge some of these component parts as well as we move forward. And so this is a, you know, we have a kind of multifaceted strategy here, but it's all designed to make sure that the average person out there in our democracy, in our country, feels like finally we're turning in their direction, we're giving them their voice back, we're making sure that they're the ones that hold the power in their own democracy. That's what H.R. 1 is about. That's what the For the People Act is all about.
Well, even those component parts, though, will meet the brick wall that is the Senate Majority Leader in Mitch McConnell, and the significant concerns that Republicans and other groups that we've talked about this hour, including the ACLU, have with aspects of H.R. 1. But Congressman John Sarbanes, Democrat of Maryland and primary sponsor of this marquee bill from House Democrats, thank you so much for spending the hour with us and for walking us through what you hope to achieve. Thank you so very much.
Thanks very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.